Welcome to the University of Michigan Press Podcast, a monthly show featuring interviews with University of Michigan Press authors. On the morning of May 18, 1927, in Bath, Michigan, Andrew Kehoe's farm caught fire. At roughly the same time, the north wing of the Bath Consolidated School exploded. Chaos ensued as those uninjured or killed by the blast worked to clear the rubble and get to the trapped children. Kehoe pulled up to the devastated scene, and shortly thereafter, his vehicle, packed with rusty farm equipment and dynamite, exploded, killing him along with Superintendent Emery Hike and several others. At the end of it all, 38 children and 6 adults, including Kehoe and his wife, were dead. Bath Massacre, America's First School Bombing by Arnie Bernstein, is the gripping account of this, America's first and largest school mass murder. Welcome, Arnie Bernstein.
Hi.
Well, this is an absolutely shocking tale. Could you set the scene for us? Describe the town, the times, and the circumstances that led up to this horrific event?
In a lot of ways, Bath was the quintessential small rural town. It's about 10 miles from the state capital of Lansing. It looks essentially today as it looked in 1927, the kind of place where everybody know their neighbors, people know who's doing what. It's got one main cross street, no stoplight, just, you know, stop signs. There's a sort of a downtown area, which is not like, you know, downtown of a main city, obviously, just a few stores. In 1927, the majority of Bath residents were farmers. There were some tradesmen. The one street downtown area had a grocery store, pharmacy, blacksmith slash auto repair shop, a community hall where they had recreational games, social gatherings, things like that. The various fraternal organizations met there. They hosted dances, stuff like that. And there were, of course, there was the Consolidated School, the Bath Consolidated School that had opened in 1922. It sort of was on a hill that pretty much overlooked the town. It was supposed to be the shining light of the town and was built as such. It really was a draw to the town. Everybody either had kids there or had family who had kids there. Everybody knew somebody involved with it. We think in 1927 is the jazz age and the height of the jazz age. And what a lot of people don't know is that Al Capone, Mr. Roaring Twenties himself, had a little summer cottage not far from Bath. But it didn't really affect the town. It didn't affect the town at all. In fact, most residents didn't even have homes wired for electricity. The morning of the bombing, men from Consumers Power, the Michigan Consumer Power Company, were putting up poles and stringing wires so residents could have electricity on demand. People who had electricity in their homes or in their buildings generally used gas-powered generators that could create electricity, but they were dependent on, you know, other fuel sources, and you run out of fuel, you run out of electricity. Kehoe was one such person. The school also had a generator. On the morning of the bombing, though, it was not working, and thus they had no electricity that day. Now, the Consolidated School itself had replaced a series of one-room schoolhouses that dotted the region. Through the late 1910s, it opened in 1922 for students in kindergarten through senior year of high school. And as I said before, just about everyone in Bath either had a child enrolled at the school or had family and friends who attended the school. There were about 275 students enrolled at the time of the bombing. Now, the school was not without some controversy. It cost money. It cost money to run the school. And Bath Consolidated, like all other schools, was financed through taxes. Some people in the area felt the taxes were too high, and Andrew Kehoe was one of those people.
Who was Andrew Kehoe? Can you give any insight as to his motivations and character?
Kehoe is a real enigma. He was born in Tecumseh, Michigan, in 1872. As a kid, he was interested in electricity, and he experimented with a lot of different machinery that he used on his father's farm. His mother died when he was a young man. And his father, Philip Kehoe, remarried a young woman named Frances Wilder. She was closer to Andrew's age than Philip's. And theory, they could have been brother and sister rather than stepmother and stepson. When he was about 19, Kehoe went to St. Louis to formally study electricity. At some point there, and we don't know how, there was an accident that put him in a coma for about 2 weeks. As I say, it's not known what happened, whether it was electrical, whether he fell. Nobody knows what happened. But as I say, he was in a coma for 2 weeks. Did this have an effect on his mind? Who can say? It's one of, again, he's an enigma, and it's one of those great unknowns. He ended up returning to Tecumseh. He spent some time in Iowa working on getting electrical power to the rural people in Iowa. Worked as a lineman here, a lineman there, and as I say, returned to Tecumseh. Worked on his father's farm. Now, there was a terrible accident at the Kehoe residence. A gasoline stove exploded and killed Francis. Years later, after the bombing and this story came to light, people wondered if Kehoe had somehow rigged the stove to kill his stepmother. Andrew Kehoe certainly had the knowledge to pull it off, and he certainly had the animosity with his stepmother. But did he do it? Some of his actions immediately after the explosion were a little odd. She was clearly covered in, you know, gasoline or oil or whatever and was burning. Kehoe, who, with his use of electricity, I'm sure knew a lot about, you know, how to put out a fire, but instead of throwing baking soda on her, as one would expect, he threw water, which caused the flame. As you know, oil and water don't mix, so water causes oil to spread, and by throwing water on her, it caused the fire to spread over her body. Her skin and body literally melted. He went to a neighbor's they did not have a phone at the Kehoe residence, so Andrew Kehoe went to a neighbor to phone for help. When he showed up the door, he was very nonchalant. He might have well been coming over to ask to borrow a shovel or something. He said, you know, there's been a little accident, you know, we need a doctor. The neighbor said, okay. He said, oh, by the way, call a priest. Very unusual. But again, did he set it? No one can say. It's one of the great unknowns. In 1912, Andrew Kehoe married Nellie Price. The two had known each other from Michigan State College, which later became Michigan State University in Lansing. Kehoe had briefly attended Michigan State and knew Nellie from there. The two bought a farm in Bath from Nellie's uncle, Lawrence Price, who was a well-known figure in Lansing. Once they moved in, Kehoe's neighbors knew there was something very different about him. He did his farming in a coat and clean white shirt, never seemed to break a sweat. Whenever he got dirt on his clean white shirt, he would go in the house and change. It in a way, he reminds me sort of Oliver Douglas from Green Acres doing his farming while wearing the suit and tie. Certainly not as silly as Oliver Douglas, to be sure. Kehoe was also considered an expert in dynamite and explosives. Now, this was not strange because farmers would use dynamite to break up old tree stumps or boulders that would stick out on their farmland. People still do this. They still use dynamite or various explosives to get rid of stumps, boulders that pockmark farmland. It's not an unusual thing. And so many farmers would come to Kehoe and say, listen, we need a boulder removed. Can you help us with this? Sure. And he would go over and explode for them. Or he was also a person they could buy dynamite from. So nothing was really odd about this. But it also seemed like Kehoe had many sides to him. On one hand, he was a polite, friendly guy, got involved in local affairs. He was, you know, a regular at, you know, some of the social events and some of the card games, things like that. It was this concern for community, and particularly how public funds got used, that caused him to run for the school board. He felt that as a taxpayer, oversight was needed on the school since public fund was going into it. And this, you know, concern for public funding got him appointed treasurer once he was elected to the school board. And he always kept his books perfectly balanced. And I do mean to the penny perfectly balanced. It was, and he was also, because of his mechanical knowledge, he was very handy and was asked to repair machinery and various other things at the school. He was given a key and pretty much had run of the place day or night whenever he wanted to go in. There was, it's kind of an interesting story, there was an infestation of bees at the school, and they built some hives in the basement, and during the winter, the furnace warmed up the bee's nest, and bees went flying through the school. They tried several times to get rid of the bee's nest, and it was a dangerous situation for students and teachers, certainly, and they tried, and they failed, and they tried, and they failed, and finally, they asked Kehoe, can you help us get rid of the bees? Kehoe said, certainly. He went into the basement. No one knows what he did, but somehow it worked, and there were no more bees. But through this knowledge, through doing all this repairs and, you know, handiwork at the school, he had intimate knowledge of every crook and cranny in that building, which, of course, helped him when he set the bomb off in the basement of the school, when he, you know, put it all together. Now, as I say, he was a double-sided personality. He, on one hand, he was friendly. People knew him. But he was also very cantankerous. He could be short-tempered. There were at least two known incidents where he killed animals. One, he shot a neighbor's dog, neighbor who lived across the street. And in another incident, he deliberately worked one of his horses to death. He drove the animal and drove the animal, and people saw him doing this. And he drove the animal to its death. Kehoe and the school superintendent, Emery Hike, they were always at odds over how the school was run and various expenditures. Kehoe felt that Hike was taking control where the school board should be controlling things. It was a very public feud. And there was always a certain feeling when the two were together, they just did not get along, constantly feuding. And Kehoe himself was a real aggravation to many board members. Whenever something did not go his way, he would make a motion to dismiss the board meeting for the night. This eventually led to his downfall. He tried running for a couple of other public offices, but did not win these offices. And he was gradually getting to be more of an annoyance on the board than, you know, a useful personality. At the same time, his home life was becoming something of a mess. His wife, Nellie, was chronically ill, always in and out of the hospital. And after a time, Kehoe simply stopped paying his mortgage. No one knows why. Years went by because the mortgage was held by Nellie's family. They did not throw them out on the street, and they made every effort to help Kehoe pay the mortgage, but he simply ignored it. He also let his farm go to seed. Blamed others for his problems. He was certainly an odd man and certainly a very troubled man. But there are a lot of odd and troubled people, and people who don't like paying their taxes, and people who stop paying their mortgages, but don't commit mass murder. There's something about him, something in him that slipped. Today we know it as a psychopathic personality. And there's something, Dr. David Hare, who's considered the expert in psychopathic studies, created what was known as the psychopathic checklist. It's sort of a gold standard for how, you know, the psychopathic personality, such as Ted Bundy, behaves, living kind of a dual life, things like that. Well, Kehoe fits many, many of the points on this psychopathic checklist. And certainly his ability to spend months and months wiring a school with explosives and building and wiring his home with explosives and building timers that would set off bombs of incredible strength to blow up a school full of children, destroy his farm, would required somebody who was able to lead a dual life.
Wow, what a very complicated character. So tell us, how did you come to write about this event?
It's an interesting story. I was inspired by some friends of mine who had written books about forgotten stories in history. One of them is a wonderful book called Alchemy of Bones, which is a very notorious case in Chicago in the 1890s, about the time of the World's Fair, where there was a very well-known sausage maker, and his wife disappeared. And people thought, well, maybe there's something in the sausages. And as I say, it was a forgotten story, and it fascinated me. And I was inspired. I said, I've got to do a book like this. How do you make something that's lost in history come to life for a modern audience? So I started poking around the internet, looking for a story. Nothing really grabbed me. And there's this website I love. It's going to make me sound a little morbid. It's called Find a Grave. And it's really an interesting site. It lists, you know, famous burials, famous memorials, things like that, around the world. And one day I came something called the Bath Memorial. So what is this? I started reading about it, and I was hooked. I'd never heard of this story. It was very compelling. The deadliest act of school violence in American history, worse than Columbine. And it seemed like nobody knew anything about it. Very little had been written about it. And the way the story unfolded, bombings, the fires, the rescue efforts, very clear-cut villain, this was a writer's dream. I knew I had a great story. And then I visited Bath and went into Pleasant Hill Cemetery, where about 17 of the children are buried and some of the adult victims. And the whole thing changed for me in an instant. It stopped being a story and seeing these stone after stone. It's, you know, child 1912, 1927, 1920, 1927, over and over repetition. It became a stark reality. This was not a forgotten story in history. It was very real and deeply tragic event. And I felt like I was no longer a writer, but I was becoming a caretaker of something and retelling it to the world, and had a very different mission as a result. I just wasn't out to tell a crackling yarn, but wanted to tell it with great sensitivity and concern for what happened and how it's affected the town through the decades, which it certainly has.
Right. I'd imagine that there'd be quite a bit of a responsibility to respect that particular event.
Yes, I did, but I didn't want to pull back either. And in fact, there was one woman I spoke with who was a survivor and had lost her little brother in the bombing. She was a woman in her 90s, and she was telling me some very intense details. And I said to her, you know, you don't have to tell me these things. You know, I didn't want to upset her. And she said, no, I want people to know. And so I did, and I did not hold back any of the horror. And I felt that was important because people had to know the extent of the horror. You know, it was important to bear witness.
Absolutely. So, saying that, what do you hope that readers will take away from reading this book?
We think of school violence as a modern phenomenon, but it really isn't. It's been around for at least 80 years, you know, since the Bath bombing, which is the first act of school violence in, you know, what we would call modern American history. I opened the book with Virginia Tech, which happened about a month before the 80th anniversary of the Bath School bombing. There were a lot of parallels about what happened that day, how Cho's story unfolded in his shooting at Virginia Tech, and how Kehoe's story unfolded as the morning of the bombing occurred in Bath. And there were a lot of feelings that were stirred up, certainly, when the Virginia Tech shooting happened, when Columbine happened. The people feel it there, feel it very deeply. It sets off a lot of memories, deeply felt emotions every time something like this happens. School violence, 9/11, things like that. By that I mean the people of Bath. In a sense, they've showed us how you get past these things, how you survive this terror and heal, you know, the best way we possibly can in the face of unimaginable horror. And this was unimaginable. They lost a whole generation of children and in a bombing beyond anyone's imagining. You know, so what do I want readers, you know, to get from the book? I guess that the human spirit is very strong. It's resilient, and collectively it's stronger as a force of good than terror and the evil of senseless acts by a tiny few.
Well, Arnie Bernstein, this sounds extremely interesting, and I thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Arnie Bernstein, author of Bath Massacre, America's First School Bombing. To learn more about our books, please visit us on the web at press.umich.edu. This podcast has been brought to you by the University of Michigan Press, copyright 2008, all rights reserved.